Hi, I'm Dr. Doron Schneider. I'm a general internist at Abington Health. That's right outside of Philadelphia. There I am the Chief Quality and Safety Officer for the health system and Deputy Program Director for Internal Medicine. And with me I have Dr. Jack Leahy. Jack.
Great. I'm Jack Leahy. I'm the endocrine chief at the University of Vermont here in Burlington, very interested in diabetes pathogenesis, but also clinical care.
Thanks, Jack. And so we are hoping in the next period of time to provide some reflections on what's occurring in diabetes care. I'd like to get your perspective on the patient who's on two agents, with an A1C greater than 8.5.
The answer to this is really important because this is a common everyday scenario in so many doctors' offices. If the standard starting drug is metformin, many providers in this country or really around the world will then use a sulfonylurea as their second choice. There used to be TZD usage that's reducing because of problems with that drug, and there certainly is more usage with a DPP-4 inhibitor. But still, having said that, let's assume a patient comes to you, and if they're on the two drugs, we'll start with metformin and its sulfonylurea. And if their A1C is 8.5%, and if the discussion with the patient is, I would like another pill, do not give me an injection, then your choices are the following. You know, you could do a TZD, an insulin sensitizer. Some people it's magical. Some people it doesn't do much. There is a weight gain potential. It's an expensive drug, and you know we're all a little bit nervous about that class of drugs these days, in part because of all this discussion about bladder issues, but also the bone fracture risk in women. So you know it's probably not going to get you to goal if you're 8.5 down to all the way down to 7, and it comes with some significant baggage. So that would be a very limited choice, quite frankly. The other kind of oral agent that people love to talk about are the DPP-4 inhibitors because they're cool and they're new, and there's a lot of discussion among the pharmaceutical companies and a lot of CME presentations, and they're just the new drugs on the block. But the problem is that their efficacy in terms of improving hemoglobin A1C is really pretty modest, as modest as our most modest drugs. And with the hemoglobin A1C of 8.5, where people are on two oral agents, if it dropped another 1% when you added a DPP-4, that would be unusual. In most situations, it's a bit less than that. So now you're going to have people on three oral agents, one of which, DPP-4, is really expensive, and they're still not going to be the goal, and you're going to be having ongoing discussions with your patient about we need to do something in addition. So the real discussion for me when you're up at 8.5 is you want to choose a therapy that has a real chance, a very significant chance of that change to get someone to goal. And the marketplace war right now is basal insulin, which I happen to love and have used, you know, for years, and I think is incredibly powerful and comes with not a lot of baggage, versus the injected incretin drugs, the GLP-1 receptor agonists. And there are many, many head-to-head trials suggesting that at that chosen level of hemoglobin A1C of 8.5%, both of those have a very significant chance of getting someone to goal, and they come with different clinical profiles. We all know the profile of insulin and the profile of the GLP-1 drugs, positive as maybe some weight loss and some improvement in cardiovascular risk factors, negative cost and negative some GI side effects. So sit down with a patient and say, well, you know, the best choice at that situation is insulin versus GLP-1. Let's talk about those two drugs, and then let's make a decision what you want to do.
I think your comments reflect very much what's going on in the primary care world. However, I think that the first half of your comments, where the patient not wanting to go to an injectable occurs more often than not. Patients, there is an injection barrier.
That's, of course, true. And one of the things that interests me is I'll have conversations with our local primary doctors, and they'll tell me that, and they'll tell me how that's an incredible barrier to intensifying therapy in their practices, and I understand that. But having said that, no one comes to my clinic who really wants to start injectables. It's not their favorite thing, and so it very much becomes the conversation of balancing pluses and minuses, and showing patients that the injection is not a big deal. So one of the things that fascinates me is I was recently in a meeting where someone showed data that about 95% of primary care doctors identified pain and or discomfort from the injection as being a major barrier in starting injectables. They knew that's what patients felt, and that was a big issue. But then when you looked at what percentage of those doctors were actually having patients injected with a needle during the office visit, it's very small. And that, to me, is a total disconnect, because as soon as someone is given a needle injection or can look at the needles or look at pens and see how incredibly small and relatively easy the system is, it really diffuses a lot of the fear. So I understand the barrier, but I think what needs to be introduced in so many practices are countermeasures against that barrier, and it becomes less of a problem.
I completely concur. I wonder if you can give us your thoughts or reflections on beta cell preservation, our current state of the science, in that we just don't know necessarily in humans, especially how these drugs may or may not preserve beta cells, you know, over long periods of time. And I wonder if you can reflect on that, and how should the primary care world be thinking about making a selection of agents based on beta cell preservation as a factor at all?
So this is a great question. I don't think we know enough in today's world to be making treatment choices based upon presumptions of how individual drugs may alter the natural history of the disease versus other drugs. Certainly, we can go back 5 or 8 years ago. One of the disappointing, I think, eye-openers in our world from the UKPDS and some of the later studies was a recognition that you can start any of our therapies that start out being reasonably effective, and with time their effectiveness wanes, and that seems to correlate in part with worsening beta cell function. And certainly there is a lot of discussion and a lot of hope that we will identify ways, be they with specific agents or through some other mechanism, to change the loss of beta cell function and therefore change response to drugs and the natural history of the disease. So the real issue is, do we have any of that with individual drugs? And I think probably the short answer is probably not. There was hope that the insulin sensitizers would do some of that, and I would say if you look at data on insulin sensitizers in a reasonably fair, balanced way, they may do better in terms of changing the natural history of the disease than some of our even prior agents to that, metformin and sulfonylurea. How long that lasts, I'm not exactly sure. And again, we're a little bit afraid of those drugs, and so that's probably not our future.
So the other agents that we've thought a lot about are the incretin agents, and the concept, the oral agents, the DPP-4 inhibitors, and the injected drugs, the GLP-1 drugs. And there was just an enormous excitement that they might actually improve beta cell biology in this disease and bring this goal of beta cell protection. That's based a lot on both of these agents having been used in rodent models with type 2 diabetes, and in both of them they acted to build the beta cell mass, something that would be spectacularly useful if it occurred in humans. And so we all waited with semi-bated breath to see if it looks like that occurs, and we don't have full information yet, but I think the prevailing opinion is probably not. So when we look at those agents now, when you take one of the drugs, especially the injected GLP-1 drugs, they seem to improve beta cell function over the long term. So if you're on the agent, it looks, even maybe 4 years out, beta cell function looks pretty good. So from a beta cell protection point of view, it may turn out that they are more effective at improving beta cell function over the long term and then having a longer duration of action in terms of efficacy than our traditional agents. But we don't know that yet, and therefore it's really premature to try and build that into a guideline. Now the last part of this conversation, and the one that's timely, is, well, could insulin actually, if used early and used aggressively, change beta cell function and be protective? And there's some information going back a few years to suggest maybe, And in particular, a very exciting study that was done in China a few years ago used insulin as initial therapy very aggressively and then stopped it. And in fact, people went into remission in the disease for more than a year, some people. And then we have the Origin trial, which was reported on just a month or two ago at the American Diabetes Association, which is using glargine Lantus insulin very early in the course of type 2 diabetes, even in some patients in prediabetes. And one of the findings of that study was the concept that people moving from prediabetes to actually type 2 diabetes seemed to be protected against better by an insulin injection as opposed to an oral agent like metformin. It was a fairly minor difference, but it was real. So maybe insulin has a modest effect for beta cell protection. But when you put all this together, I don't think any of this is so secure that this particular feature should be driving our treatment choices and be a prominent part of any treatment algorithm.
And just for clarity's sake, the idea of incretins, you refer to their durability of action, their possible preservation of function over the long haul. Would you suggest that to take fullest advantage of that durability, that there's any benefit to beginning incretins earlier, in sort of in light of your insulin comment? Should that be how we think about incretins in general?
I don't think we know yet, but it's a really, really important question. There's a fascinating study from the United Kingdom that was published a few years ago of using liraglutide, Victoza, in patients with prediabetes, and they happen to use a very large dose, a dose that's more than that's clinically approved right now. And they looked at weight reduction as one of the dominant clinical outcomes and showed that this very high dose of Victoza at 3 milligrams a day, there was just enormous weight reduction over about 20 weeks of the study. But also the prediabetes basically disappeared. There was about a 90% reversal of prediabetes to normal glycemia. You might expect that because these people lost a lot of weight. So I don't think we know, but certainly one of the big discussions in the diabetes specialty world right now is we're interested in these GLP-1 drugs, and we're trying to figure out when best to use them and what clinical benefits will come with long-term usage of these drugs, and that's still very much an open issue.
Well, thank you for your wisdom. We look forward to the feedback of the readers of and the listeners of Beta Cells and Diabetes. We'd like to hear your comments, suggestions, thoughts, and reflections on what you've heard, and please submit those at betacellsanddiabetes.org. Thank you.